You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar.
This episode was made possible by the support of our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Mythgreens Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Wes.
And...
Chris.
And today, we are actually going to adapt this podcast into a role-playing game. So I feel like we need to make a few stats, like broadcasting and use Audacity, or, you know, use Magic Audacity as the case may be. But I think this will be a really fun role-playing setting, because it's got conflict and everything, right?
Yeah.
Are we gonna, to increase the conflict in the setting, are we gonna start making provocative statements?
Yeah, I think we better. So let's see, Game of Thrones... I don't know. I got nothing.
After all the provocative things that we say on the blog, once we're on the podcast, we're like, something provocative.
Something. Anger everyone?
I can't say it all. I can't do it on purpose. It just has to happen, you know?
I mean, if I were to guess, I'd say that our podcasts are somewhat less anger-inducing just because people can, like, hear our tone of voice, right? You know, when we talk about Harry Potter, we usually, like, also talk about what's good about Harry Potter. Whereas on the blog, people sometimes, like, you're always being so mean to Harry Potter. Why?
Oh, speaking of being mean to Harry Potter, okay, so because today we're talking about adapting settings into role-playing games, right? Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, the number one reason why settings don't work as role-playing games is magic. And Harry Potter is, like... primo offender, number one, the most offensive in this regard, because its magic is absurd. There's no way to balance it. You just can't do it. There's so many things in there that can be abused that your players will abuse. They will find them. They will realize that they can, you know, combine all these different magics and they can stockpile potions and time turners exist and it goes so on and so forth. And it will be bad. It's just don't. Just save yourself the bother.
But Oren, me and my friends want to role play witches and wizards at Hogwarts. What do we do?
I don't know. Find a better GM than me.
here's a question. Is Harry Potter, the way that it works, really that different from like D&D, where you have like a set spell list? Like, could you just make an alternate D&D type spell list for Harry Potter with Harry Potter spells in it, and then like if one is really way too powerful, just make it a higher level? Like, you don't learn that until your last year at Hogwarts or something.
That's not a bad idea.
You could do that, but the amount of work it would take is pretty ridiculous. Harry Potter is not the only setting that has unbalanced magic, but it is certainly one of the most unbalanced settings, because like every book has to introduce new magic, and unlike say the Dresden Files, which also does this, at least in the Dresden Files there is like a limiter on magic that they build in, which gives you a way to make more powerful magic less broken. Mm-hmm. Which is that like magic makes you tired and the more powerful magic makes you tireder. Mm-hmm. That ain't in Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. Like there's nothing, so you could like invent a new limiter from scratch, or you could do the D&D style where it's like you only learn the spell that like causes a spinning horde of blades to appear at like sixth level, or you could make it so that that spell, despite being super impressive looking, only does 2d6 of damage. You know, mm-hmm. you certainly have options, but it's hard. It's going to be a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. So let's dial it back a little bit. Okay, so somebody uh-huh. says, I really want to adapt Harry Potter, that setting, uh-huh. for a role-playing game. I think what we need to do, and I've heard people say like, oh, I really like that, you know, TV show or that book, and like I think that should be a good game. Well, if you're struggling with that, then I think you probably should take a moment to stop and ask yourself why that setting. Write things down. What is it about the atmosphere, the characters, the magic, the monsters, the treasure, or boats, or whatever, if it's in space, you know, all of those things. If you write down a list of why that setting is appealing for you, I bet you could probably find something similar, you know, that already exists that you could run an adventure with. You know, like, just because you say you want the Harry Potter world doesn't mean that that's a unique world. Like, there are plenty of things that exist there that could also work in existing role-playing games or in other stories or things like that. So just take a break, slow down, and realize what you're really looking for when you want to adapt a setting.
Yeah, and I think for, in a lot of cases, when it's, you're going for a particular genre or a particular aesthetic or a particular atmosphere, you know, that probably would work really well. I do know that there's so many people who are just avid fans of Harry Potter that giving them a hot Harry Potter-like setting that was not Harry Potter, for some of those people who are just super, super in, who, like, identify with a house, you know, there are a lot of those people out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right that in many cases you could just do that. And of course, the resort you can always take for any setting that just does not work, you know, for the magic system, is to just go with something super soft where it's abstracted and so it doesn't really mechanically matter what you're doing, which like something like Primetime Adventures, I think if I were to theoretically run Harry Potter, I would just have to make it a Primetime Adventures game.
Right, and like the thing about Harry, and this is not just a Harry Potter issue, although it is the easy one to identify, is that if people are into it, like, because they are that devoted to the setting, like, you maybe don't want to use that one anyway, because chances are your idea of what the setting is will be different than theirs, and are you prepared to have that fight at your role-playing table, okay? Like, do you want to have the Hufflepuff argument while you're trying to run a game?
I mean, it's true. It's like, almost you have to be, like, the most into that world of anybody at the table, because they will argue, you know, with what is canon, and if you're not prepared.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I've had this problem even though I've never run Harry Potter, right? Like, I've had this problem with other settings and with that were not nearly so beloved. Mm-hmm. And there is definitely an advantage to using an actual setting, not just, you know, adapting the elements of it that people like. You know, if it's something like Firefly, for example, at least, and that this is less true now than it used to be, but, like, you could used to, if you sat down with a group of nerds, you could be pretty well sure that they'd all seen Firefly, and that, like, they had that collective knowledge of what the Firefly setting was all about.
Mm-hmm.
So you could, like, sit them down and be like, all right, guys, now we're playing a game in Firefly. And they're like, well, I know what a Migbolt transport is. You don't have to explain that. Super easy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And Firefly comes with a specific sort of packaged sci-fi Western aesthetic that would take explaining if you're doing it outside of Firefly. But with Firefly, everybody, it integrated those themes so well that all of your players are like, oh yeah, I instantly get that sci-fi Western aesthetic.
But what's still nice, though, is, like, you can take, like, if you break it down, it's like, what do I like about Firefly? It's like, oh, there's, you know, tech available, but not everybody has it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have to live in somewhat, like, you know, rural and primitive conditions. Like, that right there is a great setting for anything. Like, you can run with that. It doesn't have to be the Firefly universe, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
It's easy to break that down. I'm not saying you should go try to make, like, your own cowboys versus aliens, but I'm sure you could do something much better than that.
Yeah, but it's true. The most of the things that really make the Firefly universe valuable, you could just make your own version of it and it would work just fine. It's not like Harry Potter where there's, like, specific house names that people are really attached to.
Right.
You know, it's you could make your own world that has a big contrast between rich, high-tech people sort of living in real dense environments and, like, people who are living out on the fringe and have little technology and are, you know.
One more thing to actually say about Firefly, because, you know, they made a role-playing game for it.
They did.
And I played it, and there's a lot in there about piloting your spaceship. And
yeah.
And so much. And so one of our characters, players, was the pilot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm like, okay, well, let's start. You're in space and, you know, like, you got to navigate some debris and like space rocks or whatever, and you got to land on the planet. And so what would definitely have been a very cool sequence of events for a television show just amounted to all of us watching this guy roll like a series of dice. And it was such like, it was just not very like exciting at all. It's like, you know, it's like, okay, that's something that I know that I just like can't really do. It's like, roll to see how well you steer through the asteroid field. Oh, you rolled okay. The ship takes damage. You're gonna have to pay to get that repaired when you land. Like, it's just, it's not as good as the TV show. So like, that would be something that I would not really want to include unless I could somehow find a better way to do it.
Yeah, that is a really hard thing, because it's so much easier when you have a visual medium to mm-hmm. make those kinds of action scenes really exciting, you know, because they're so visceral. And then when you go to a role-playing setting, it doesn't really feel real or impactful unless you give it mechanics.
Yeah.
But then to try to, it's almost impossible to map all of the mechanics of any kind of like physical action sequence, whether it's flying a ship or people fighting or a whole battle taking place, onto role-playing mechanics and have it actually be interesting instead of boring, because in the end you're just sitting at a table rolling dice over and over again.
Right.
And it's not like it's impossible, but most of the time that probably shouldn't be attempted.
There were also, one more thing though. There's also just like no stakes for that, because it was like the first, like literally the first thing in that adventure. And so like, you know, what was I gonna do? Like, if he failed his rolls, like your ship explodes. You know, like there was no other than like damaging parts of it that they would need to repair. There wasn't like a good fail scenario for that. Like, there wasn't any like real meaning to the scene, which. Yeah, took away from.
Yeah,
it.
I mean, like the primary buffer panel falls off, whatever. Yeah. You know, and I mean, well, and that's a concern whenever you're adapting something into a role playing game. If it's something that like only one character or maybe even two characters out of a party can participate in, you don't want to spend a lot of time on it,
right.
And you get the same problem in settings like Shadowrun or any settings that have like a Matrix style computer system, where it's like, all right, one of us is a hacker and can do stuff in the Matrix and everybody else can't, so by the letter of the rules, what we should do is every time we need to do something in the Matrix, everybody else like goes and gets pizza, and then the one hacker character Matrix adventure. Like, that's theoretically what you should be doing according by the letter of the rules. Now, of course, most people know better than that. Mm-hmm. But like, you can get caught by surprise if it's your first time and you're like, open up the rules and you're like, oh man, there's all this stuff for spaceships. This must be important. 5 hours later, I kind of wish we hadn't done that. You know.
Yeah.
So what I've noticed is that there are sort of two reasons to adapt a setting to be a role playing game. And one of them is what we already talked about with Firefly and just having that shared knowledge base.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get that either by saying it's Firefly or you can even tell your players, this is like Firefly. It's, you know, it's like Firefly, except instead of the Western aesthetic, all of the more rural, less developed places have a Warring States China aesthetic, mm-hmm. right? You know, mm-hmm. you can do stuff like that. Or the other reason I've found is that there is some like very interesting dynamic in the game or like in the material that you're converting, and you want to experience that as a role-playing game. So with Firefly, that would probably be the experience of managing your ship. Like, that's probably the single most like consistent theme throughout Firefly.
Mm-hmm.
Is trying to keep your ship flying in the face of, you know, the Alliance trying to shut you down and the Reavers trying to eat you and all that nonsense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to do that, then you're going to need to be way more mechanically, like, prepared. And frankly, the Firefly RPG, while not terrible, it does not prepare you to do that. Like, its version of keep your ship flying is, are you ready to count a bunch of credits? Because that's what you're going to do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what about sort of experiences that depend, because Firefly is definitely one of the, an experience where they have to be poor to really simulate that experience of trying to keep the ship running. And, you know, a lot of noir, for instance, the detective is supposed to be scrabbling for funds and have to take cases that, you know, the detective would otherwise mm-hmm. not want to take. It seems like that is also kind of one of the trickier things to bring into role-playing, because players are really good at making money.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's why you need a super robust economy system, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if your game is about resource management, like, at all, it needs to be really baked into the rules. Because, like, even if your characters aren't magic, they will find ways to make money because they are very highly skilled individuals, right? Mm-hmm. And if they're magic, then all bets are off, right? They can just kind of get money whenever they want. So, you know, it's impossible to replicate the Harry Dresden scenario unless your players are just really devoted to it, where it's like, I didn't want to work for that weird, like, fairy who walked into my office, but I was low on funds and I couldn't pay my rent, so I had to. It's like, you know, no, any PC who you tell that to will be like, okay, I cast summon wedding ring and sell all the wedding rings that I summoned. Mm-hmm. Whatever. So that's why, but that's why you need something like Torchbearer, which has like a very like devoted system of like, nah, man, you gotta go adventuring because you can't afford to stay at this inn one more night, and they're gonna kick you out, and you don't have any marketable skills except going into holes in the ground and bringing treasure back. So get out there.
Chris, you mentioned like noir and stuff, and like I've been, when I was thinking about this podcast, you know, like there's, when you're adapting a setting, I do again bring up this, like, what exactly do you want to adapt? Because if you are watching like a really popular like detective show, True Detective, maybe like Sherlock or something like that, like that just is, you know, like really heavily rooted in like mystery and like the whodunit stuff, ask yourself, who are you going to be creating this game for? And are they going to buy in on your adapted horror setting, your adapted mystery setting? I mean, I've been in good games, Chris, yours definitely included, where like the spook happens, like it's there, but more than half the time we're probably kind of laughing, you know, or like making jokes and stuff like that. So if you're like fascinated by some gritty noir like show or book or whatever, like, ask yourself if that's really going to translate with your players, because it might not. They might not buy into it, and all of your hard work, you'll just be disappointed, right?
Yeah.
Like, so that the medium matters, and the genre especially.
Yeah, well, player buy-in, I think, is incredibly important. You know, like with the game I'm running, where I have like this kind of like mystery factor that is sometimes eerie and sometimes just fun. It's working because you guys are all, you just let it be a mystery, right? You're not, like, my players have bought in. You guys are not, you're not trying to actively take apart and dissect it in every moment, right?
My character is perfectly content with this flower that just hangs out with him that doesn't need water or sun or soil. It's growing beautifully.
Be just fine, don't worry.
It's your best friend. Not
it's my best friend.
And so definitely depending on the genre, and I think again the darker, more serious stuff in role playing, because it does tend towards funny, it does tend towards slapstick, you know, the more darker and serious, you know, whatever, the more player buy in you need to get it to work.
Well, I was just gonna say that in most cases, when you're talking about a mystery story, if you're, especially if it's designed to be creepy in any way, and this is true of, like, you know, trying to adapt Lovecraft or trying to adapt the stuff that's in the Southern Reach, you have to be so careful the way that you introduce this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it has to be really careful, and like the players have to be having fun already, and then you slowly start to put in stuff that seems a little weird and a little odd, right? Because, and then, like, the players have to come to it on their own, because if it, like, jumps out and startles them, their immediate response will be like, no, I'm not going to be startled. I don't like being afraid. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and then it's all ruined, right? Yeah. And, like, Chris, you picked up on that in your game, like, super fast. and that's exactly what you're doing. And so, you know, most of what we do in that game is be high schoolers and, like, try to deal with the upcoming soccer game and, like, doing good on our history reports. Mm-hmm. And then, like, for some reason, I walk into class and all the popular kids are staring at me. And it's like, what is happening, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that seems really weird.
Yeah, with the eerie mystery stuff, you definitely have to not do too much. You know, because as soon as you do too much, it's going to lose its novelty. And in this case, having a game where there were other plot lines going on that would hold up the game, that would allow this other thing to just kind of, like, intrude, you know, was real important to the atmosphere.
One other thing to add in here is if you like puzzles, riddles, ciphers for your mystery games or anything like that, I would caution you with those because players will jump immediately out of character if they like puzzles, and they will just solve them. You know, it's like you might have this great thing planned out where, like, you know, to fix this cipher that you found on the internet, right? Because you needed a cipher, they have to go to X and ask Y to figure out Z. But no, your player might not want to role play, might just want to figure out how to do it themselves and be like, oh, I solved it. It's the alphabet backwards plus two characters, you know, something like that. It's just like, and that could just be so frustrating when that happens, right? Be careful. People love puzzles and they will break character to solve them.
Right. And then there's, of course, the other way where you give them a puzzle and you're expecting them to solve it as, like, players, and they, like, have trouble and get frustrated.
Also that, yes.
Yeah, that's definitely hard to manage.
Yes.
Right. And here, so another thing to consider when you're looking at a setting that you want to adapt is very often you want to consider the potential for adventure rather than a specific adventure. Like, one of the reasons why I would probably not ever try to adapt Battlestar Galactica, even though it does actually have an RPG, is that it's too specific. Like, there is exactly one story you can tell in Battlestar Galactica, which is the story of the fleet trying to flee the Cylons.
Mm-hmm.
And like, even assuming that you remove all of the canon characters and put your PCs in their place, you know, like Commander Badama and President Rosalind, you know, even assuming you do that, it's still an extremely specific story. Like, that's certainly what people are interested in. Now, the alternative, of course, is that you could adapt the 12 colonies as a setting, but there's not really that much there to work with, right? Like, we don't really know very much about the 12 colonies, nothing particularly interesting about them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something like Star Wars, especially if you're at all an EU fan, like, the Star Wars setting is so sprawling and huge that the potential for adventure is basically infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And so it provides, that's the reason why it keeps getting turned into role-playing games and why each of its role-playing games is pretty good. You know, I don't think any of them are going to win any design prizes, but they're all pretty good. They all work and you can have fun with all of them. Mm-hmm. So that's something to consider a lot of.
That's a really good point, Oren. I was just thinking about, like, potential and maybe something to also consider when you're adapting is actually just, are you doing a one shot or a campaign, right? Like, because mm-hmm. maybe you could do your Battlestar Galactica as a one shot, right? Like, not as something sustainable in that kind of environment. So maybe that's just something else to add to your checklist of considerations when you're thinking about some new setting to adapt.
I think Battlestar Galactica would particularly lend itself to one shot because of the Cylon element, where you can have a surprise reveal where somebody's a Cylon.
Yeah.
Which I think is it's a really good twist for a role-playing game, but might be harder for a longer campaign. I am remembering a certain one-shot Eclipse Phase game where I found out that I was the big bad. In Eclipse Phase, you can make copies of yourselves. They're called forks, and then, like, remerge. And it turned out it was a lost copy of myself that was causing.
Yeah, that's what happens when you just leave your forks lying around. They turn evil. You know, you got to be careful with that.
So here's a question for you guys. So normally when we, you know, take a setting and you want to put it in an RPG, you kind of expect to have the same type of plot line and the same type of conflicts, but that's not necessarily true. And sometimes a lot of problems with a setting can actually be changed or fixed just by having different types of conflicts. Like, for instance, let's say we had a Harry Potter setting, but instead of having problems where we're fighting a dark wizard and using spell work, instead we have, you know, we're in school and we have nothing but social conflicts, right? With this, with students, you know, dealing with each other between different houses and stuff like that. So the emphasis has been moved from the magic to, you know, socializing. Now, obviously, like, players have certain expectations, and normally if they're playing Harry Potter, they might expect something different. But have you ever tried something like that? Does it seem like something that could work?
Yeah, so I've actually had stuff like that. Sometimes I'm actively subverting a setting. Sometimes it's more, you know, just like trying to do something a little different. I usually try to pitch it that way in the, you know, when I'm telling my players what the game is about, right? Because I don't want my players to sign up for a Harry Potter game thinking that they're going to fight Voldemort and then have it not be about that, right? That would be, my players would have cause to complain at that point. But, you know, if I have run, say, for example, a Lord of the Rings game where, like, I specifically, like, pitched it as more of a, as, like, subverting a lot of the Lord of the Rings tropes of being, like, more of, like, a cosmopolitan Lord of the Rings, where there's more, like, mixing between the different species, and, like, there's, you know, it's more of a political situation. So I've run that and had fun with it. But, like, I pitched it that way. I didn't, like, say, all right, everybody, we're playing Lord of the Rings, and then they all show up with their fellowship characters, and I'm like, nah, nah, nah. Get out your bureaucracy roles, because this is going to be exciting.
I can't say that I've done something exactly like that, but I did, on an earlier podcast, we talked about inspiration and how Avatar is a really great world for RPGs. And so, I mean, in that adventure, I guess I strayed from the Last Airbender's plot of having, like, one nation be primarily, you know, antagonistic and the source of all struggle, instead of just focusing on having the party there to just go basically do random adventures that involved a lot more, you know, like, social checks by dealing with, like, local bureaucracy instead of just showing up Korra style and flame blasting everything to pieces. So she has a very distinctive way of solving problems for the most part. But I think personally, the social aspects are, like, some of the most fun parts of me for RPGs. And so I like focusing on those even in combat heavy settings. And, you know, I play a lot of D&D, but I try to emphasize the social side of that a lot more than the combat. Just, it's personal preference, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it's just naturally easier to make social problems occur and make it so that there's not overpowered ways to deal with them. As long as you don't, you know, allow D&D style, either A, I've done, like, a charm spell that just changes somebody's mind, or, you know, recognizing that there are limits to what you can convince people to do. You know, it's not like you have 30 charisma, now you can convince anyone, right?
Yeah, and you can get a lot of mileage out of adapting settings specifically to answer questions that the original story did not answer. And, like, so one of my most successful early games was a Firefly game where I flipped the script and had the players playing as the crew of an Alliance patrol ship.
Good one.
Because one of the questions that Firefly inevitably raises and does not answer, possibly because it didn't have time, is what's life like for the Alliance? You know, we get the whole thing from the perspective of, like, former independence fighters, and it's like, you know, how does the other side view this? And what's their deal? So that was how I pitched the game, and, like, apparently my players were very interested in finding out what the Alliance was doing on the other side of that divide, and we had great fun.
That's cool.
And same thing with my Avatar game, where it's like Avatar kind of raises the question of, like, so what's the world like? Well, there is no Avatar, right? Like, you know, that's, like, a question that is raised that the show so far has not answered. And so I got a lot of mileage out of answering that question. And so if you can figure out what those questions are, that's a really good place to start your adaptation, to be like, okay, gonna like find out. So for Lord of the Rings, it could be like, what is it about whoever these Easter and Sutherlings are that made them think signing up with Sauron was a good idea? Like, you know, what is happening with their deal? Like, who are these people? And you can like explore that, and there's just, you know, there's just a lot of potential there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could be a society where, like, for some reason the electorate decides to elect Sauron, you know, as leader, and
oh gosh,
now you have to start a resistance movement. Sorry.
If to kind of call back to inspiration, and if you're looking for good subversions, there's a book that's free online, and we can put it in the show notes, but it's called The Last Ring Bearer. Mm-hmm. Have you guys heard of this, The Last Ring Bearer?
I have not.
Okay, so no. It was written by a Russian geologist and geographer who was just fascinated with Lord of the Rings, and he wanted to like kind of write a paper on why Middle Earth's, you know, geology is kind of weird. But he ended up writing a story told from the perspective of basically a foot soldier and a low-ranking officer on the Mordor side. And it's really good because, you know, he's definitely drawing on like Cold War conflict between like, you know, how Soviet propaganda and American propaganda characterized like the respective nations and stuff. But that idea that like the people of Mordor like are just basically normal people, but that the account of the Lord of the Rings was written by the victors, and so they characterized them as monsters in order to justify what they did to them. So like I definitely recommend it. It's a very good story, and a large part of it's mostly kind of a detective thriller, but it's definitely fun to like subvert that setting for, you know, the story from the other people's perspective.
Yeah,
I'm into that. All right, so the ring bearer. All right, the last ring bearer. Last I'll ring put bearer. That in the show notes. All right, well, we are out of time. Thank you both for talking to me about this. It's been a very fascinating topic. Those of you at home, if anything that we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythcrants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. As your eyes open, a haunting melody fades to silence. Strange symbols circle the floor, and someone lying next to you is dead. Can you put the pieces together before you meet your doom? Find out by playing our standalone RPG, The Voyage, for sale on mythcreans.com. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast, opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.